I'm Professor Brad Fulton, and welcome to my Stats Podcast. This is an edited audio recording of my course. Each lecture is its own episode, and there's a total of 24 lectures. This course provides an introduction to the quantitative methods social scientists and data analysts use to collect and evaluate empirical data about society. Through this course, you will learn to gather, describe, and analyze data with an emphasis on the application and interpretation of these methods. This course will also help you to be a more informed and critical reader of academic research, public opinion polling, and advertisement claims that present statistical evidence. Although some of the current events I reference might be dated, the content is timeless. I hope you enjoy this lecture, and if you have any questions, you can email me at bradrfulton@gmail.com. Hi, my name is Professor Fulton. If you like this podcast, you'll love the book I use for the course. It's titled Statistics, Unlocking the Power of Data. This book uses a highly intuitive approach to help students visualize statistical concepts, which accelerates understanding. I've reviewed dozens of textbooks, and Unlocking the Power of Data is hands down the best one out there, mainly because of its unique intuitive approach and straightforward explanations. You can find a link to the textbook in the show notes, and if you use the promo code LOCK5, you'll get a 10% discount.
I was listening to NPR this morning, and they had a thing on the Racial Justice Act in North Carolina. The Senate passed it, but then the governor vetoed it, and then the Senate overrode the veto. But the whole point of the Racial Justice Act was giving people who have been convicted of a crime an opportunity to use statistical evidence to show that there's discrimination in their case and how they were tried. And so here's just a quick clip from NPR that talks about this that I thought was relevant.
The Senate also overrode the governor's veto of a bill that would water down the Racial Justice Act. The act allows death row prisoners to appeal their sentences using statistical evidence to show discrimination, and lawmakers overturned...
The thing that I thought was interesting is that in law, in criminology, in different fields, people are using statistical evidence more and more because in the past you could claim, well, hey, there's been discrimination, and so I've been tried unfairly. But now they're doing this more and more of incorporating statistical evidence to show empirically that discrimination has occurred. Again, another example of relevance to our field. And then we'll get started. Today we're going to be talking about collecting data and the focus being on sampling. Do you guys go to Costco? Okay, I'm going to use my kids a lot, but I love going to Costco on Saturday around noon. Any idea why? Exactly. Almost every aisle has samples. And so this is related. If you want to get a sense of what Costco has as a store, you go and you sample the samples. And we're very good at sampling the samples. It'd be too overwhelming to itemize everything that Costco has. So you go and you sample, and then that gives you a sense, okay, here's the different types of products that Costco carries. And so in the same way with collecting data on any type of population, you sample, although it's not as fun as the sampling at Costco. So what we distinguish between is a population versus a sample. And so the population, whenever they talk about a population, they're talking about all the individuals or objects of interest that you're interested in. We most commonly hear about like the U.S. population, but populations can be other bound units that you're interested in. A population could be all prisoners in the U.S., or a population could be all nonprofit organizations in the state of North Carolina. So population is ultimately the thing that we're interested in. We're wanting to make claims about different populations. Now, a sample is all the cases that we've collected data on. It's typically a subset of the population. So we have the big population that we're interested in, and then the sample is what we extract from that population to understand what's going on in the bigger picture. And so then the key mechanism here is statistical inference. It's basically the process of using data gathered from the sample to gain information about the whole population. So the big picture, if you want to look at it more visually, is we have this population that we're interested in, and it could be all types of populations, and then we pull a sample from it because it'd be unreasonable and probably not economically feasible to do the whole population. So you take a sample, and this is known as sampling. But this is actually much more difficult than you would think. But then ultimately, we then gather information about this sample, and then we can make inferences about the larger population. So what are some reasons why researchers would gather data from a sample of the population rather than gathering data on the entire population?
Too big of a number,
okay. Any others, Brittany?
It's impossible to ask every single person.
Okay.
You're looking at the United States population, it's impossible to ask every single person.
To get every person, yeah.
Economically,
tangibly. Yep, very good.
Take way too long,
exactly. Although what's interesting is the census is unique in that they actually do count every person. Now they have like the short form that everyone fills out and then the long form that only goes to a subset of the population. But there are times when you can do a census. But in general, it's just all around better, more efficient to get a sample. And ultimately, we can get the same results or the same answers by looking at the sample. And that's what statistical inference is, how you can take information from a sample to project it out onto the whole population. But there's problems with sampling. Here's an example. How many of you remember the 2000 election? So Florida was an interesting state. On the news, 8 p.m., they said Gore takes Florida. And then about, 6 hours later, they changed their mind. And they said, no, Bush takes Florida. And then for another month and a half, they went back and forth trying to figure it out. But what was interesting is at 8 p.m. and at 2 a.m., not all the votes have been counted. And so they were taking a sample of votes casted and projecting out who the winner would be. Now, if you're watching the news that night, you just saw tons of bantering going back and forth. And I'm going to show you a clip from one of the guys who was talking about the errors with this projection. What I want you to do, though, is listen to the different problems or challenges with taking a sample and using that sample to project out to the total population.
Everybody goes in, everybody comes from somewhere else in the Caribbean, goes to there as a result, and it is kind of a kaleidoscopic state. I still go back to the thing I did with Pat Cadell. How in God's earth do you project when you're only halfway through a game? Who's going to win the whole game when you're dealing with Cuban Americans, Caribbean Americans, Haitians, you're dealing with Dominicans, you're dealing with snowbirds from Minnesota moved down south, you've got New Yorkers living in the Gulf Coast. How do you do it? How do you project a state like that? Paul, I'll give you a break. How do you project a state like that with half the return system?
Well, I should have had models to do it.
Just now, the absentee ballot, have you modeled it?
16 years of my life affecting elections, not predicting. Don't just pay me to predict an election. No, what they do is they get the exit polls.
Right.
Then what they ought to do, and I think they do, is take a look at key target precincts that often serve as ballot, and they model that against...
Can you do that with absentee ballots after this proportion?
Yeah, it depends on how many there are and what the traditional proportion. Now, absentee ballots in most states trend Republican, but in Florida, you have a whole lot of seniors who may well be voting absentee who are very Democratic.
Okay, just in that short clip, what are some potential sampling biases or problems with sampling that you heard or picked up on?
They were talking about the variety of different people who live in Florida, mm-hmm. and they tend to be really scattered voters, so
uh-huh.
if you only take one precinct, they don't like, they're more likely to be, like, the age difference in Florida would be moving down there. So it's really hard to just take parts of it.
Exactly. Any others that you guys heard? What about the comment where he said, how can you project the outcome when you're only 50% of the way through the game? Is that a valid concern? Or if you only have 50% of the votes collected, could you make an estimate, a pretty strong, convincing estimate? Yeah.
Like he used the analogy of a game.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes you know you're going to win the game half victor, so it just depends. Like
uh-huh.
some states you're going to be able to predict right now who's going to win and you're going to be right.
So. Yeah.
But in, Florida being the example, probably not, because it could go so many ways.
Uh-huh. A game is a harder one to predict the outcome. But let's say with votes, there's 100,000 votes and you've already counted 50,000 of them. Do you think it's possible to just stop right there and say with almost absolute certainty who the winner would be? Uh-huh. Yeah. Let's say there's candidate A and candidate B. If candidate A has a really high proportion of those 50,000 and candidate B has few, it's almost like impossible for candidate B to catch up because you know candidate B is not going to get all the other 50,000 votes or whatever. And actually, if you watch any type of election, it's phenomenal, and it's, you probably see it most vividly in those situations where it's like 4 p.m. and 38% of the votes are counted and they've already called the election. And you're kind of like, well, how how can they do that? I mean, there's still more votes out there than the ones that they've counted, so how would they know? Well, this is where, one, where statistics comes in, but also, more importantly, what's the sample that they're looking at? That's sort of what we're going to be talking about today, is how you can, with a very, very small sample, project what the whole population, the direction the whole population is going to go in. But before we do that, we're going to talk about different potential sampling bias, which can throw this off. If you have the wrong sample or a bad sample, then you can't make any type of projections. So sampling bias occurs when your sample doesn't reflect the population. It's skewed in some direction, and it's just not a clear reflection of the population. We already covered this. In what ways could the sample have been biased in the projected Florida elections? They might have only been looking at a few precincts, and those precincts were maybe dominated by Cuban Americans, and Cuban Americans were more inclined to vote Democrat, and they weren't pulling from precincts that were high numbers of retirees who would be inclined to vote Republican, or they didn't even have information on a huge population of absentee ballot people. So when they're trying to project for the whole state, you need to make sure that your sample includes all the potential participants. So the absentee ballot people weren't even included in their estimations. Ultimately, if sampling bias exists, we can't make accurate inferences about the population. So we can make inferences, but they're not going to be accurate. And that's really what we want, is accurate inferences. And inferences, again, it's one of these terms that you're going to hear a lot. It's not one that you use in everyday language. But it's, what can we infer, or what can we conclude about the population based on this information? I mean, you're going to hear inference a lot. What can we know as a result of this information? So you have population, and that's usually signified with a capital N. And capital N is in reference to the number in the population. Then through sampling, you gather a smaller sample, which is little n. And so little n is the size of your sample. So these are important distinctions. Large n is the total number of people in the population. Small n is the number of people in your sample. So the goal is to select a sample that resembles the population but is smaller. Because technically in Florida, they could have went to every single person and say, how did you vote? Or actually, they could have just looked at the ballots and counted every ballot, but they wouldn't know until a couple of days later. In fact, it was a month and a half later, after they did count every single ballot. Let's say we're doing a study and we want to know what proportion of Duke students took a course during summer session. So you think of, what is our population? Duke students, okay? So we want to know about all Duke students, but we don't have the money or the time to ask every single Duke student. So we're going to take a sample, and from that sample, project out and make an inference about the whole population. So in what ways would the sample be biased if the sample was every student in this class? You know, I want to know all Duke students, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to ask these guys. How would it be biased?
Well, when are you asking it? If you're asking it now, we're already here.
Uh-huh.
So you can't, that's, you'd be biased that way.
Yeah, exactly. You actually are all in summer sessions. If I did my study, I would say, oh my goodness, I took a sample of Duke students and every single one of them was taking summer session classes. It's amazing. Every Duke student takes summer session classes, or at least all the ones I talked to. A little bit more tricky, and I think Brittany touched on this. What if I asked every student who's an athlete? So I said, okay, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't ask people in my summer session class, you know, use that as my sample. But what if I said, okay, well, I have good access to the athletic department, and so I'm just going to go throughout the athletic department, look at every team roster, and ask, is this person taking summer session? In what ways would the sample be biased?
A lot of athletes are required to be here.
Okay. So even though not all athletes are taking summer session, there's a higher proportion, or they're more likely to. So what if I did this? I said, okay, well, I'm just going to look at the roster for the sociology department and use that as my sample. Would that be reflective of all Duke students, or would that have bias? We need some other people engaging.
Rachel. Well, because you're only asking like one major.
Uh-huh.
So it wouldn't reflect every, and maybe like some classes aren't offered.
Okay.
In the summer, so they wouldn't stay. Sociology is more likely to be offered in the summer.
Yeah. Say it's limited to these three. Which sample would be the least biased?
Sociology department.
Why?
Like I said, athlete forced into it. I mean, a sociology department, it's more, not everyone's athletes, there's all kinds of students.
Yeah.
So it is, also a small sample of like the Duke population.
Uh-huh, yeah. So it's not necessarily the best sample, but it's more reflective of the whole population, especially compared to if I just sampled this class. Okay, so what would be a good sample to use in order to make inferences about all Duke students? What would you guys recommend? If I gave you this problem and I said, I want to know what proportion take summer session, I'm not going to let you count every single student, how would you get a sample? Where would you pull your sample from?
You do like a freshman, almost like a second semester freshman seminar where there's like, a big
one
that has like 150 students of
what, kind? Yeah, that'd be a great one. And then you could say, in this freshman seminar, is it every freshman has to take this seminar? And so they're all in there. And so then you could just ask the people in there, are you taking summer session or did you? So yeah, I mean, that's the sense is thinking through how can we pull a subset of the population that is reflective of the entire population? And it's a lot harder than you think. Probably the best way to do it is to take a random sample, randomly select people. The way a random sample works is imagine putting the name of every Duke student into a hat and then drawing out the names at random to form a sample. Okay, so this is an example of a random sample that was done with the 2008 election. So it says Gallup poll. How many of you heard of Gallup poll? They do public opinion research on a wide variety of things, but a lot of things they do is with elections. So they took a random sample of 2,847 Americans, and it says 52% of those sampled supported Obama. So when they did a random sample, they sort of have a list of all the names of people in the U.S., and they randomly select 2,847 people. So in the actual election, it says 53% of Americans voted for Obama. What's amazing to me is that they estimated from 2,800 people that 52% were going to vote for Obama, and in the outcome, when they all the numbers were tallied, 53%. So that's a pretty good estimation based on a really small number. In fact, 2,847 is 1/1,000th of 1% of the U.S. population. So the U.S. population is 330 million people. And by randomly sampling 2,800 people, they were able to make an inference about the entire population. So it's much more cost-effective to just ask 2,847 people than it would be every time they want to know a public opinion to ask 330 million people. It's an efficient, powerful tool, and what we're going to look at is how do you do random sampling? Because if Gallup would have went out on the street and asked all the people in Durham who they're going to vote for, that's not a random sample. Even though Durham has a lot of diversity, it's not reflective of the whole population. So selecting a random sample, and this is what we're going to be thinking about as we're thinking about the sample that we're looking at, there's two options. One is to draw the names out of a hat, and option two, which is just a simple way of doing it, is generate random numbers. So you number every student or the Duke ID, and you assign it a number, and then you generate random numbers to decide what units get sampled. And I'm going to show you, this is just a funny application. So this is a random number generator. Like if I said, I want you to pick numbers 1 through 10,000, I want you to pick 100 random numbers, it's kind of actually difficult. You're like, well, I don't know, how do I pick a random number, or what's a random number? There's programs out there, you input, here's the total population, and we want to do a random sampling of a subset of that. And so let's say our population, how many Duke students are there? Do you guys know, undergrads? 6,000, and we want a sample of 60. So let's assume of these 6,000 Duke students, we give everyone a number, and we want a random sampling of these 6,000, and we want a sample of 60 people. Plug in these numbers. Okay, here's the randomly generated sample. And so then what I would do is I'd go with the first number, 5457, and I'd look on my roster, and I'd be like, okay, this person's in the study. And then 5722, look at my roster, say, okay, this person's in the study. And so this is completely randomly selected people. I'm not going to the athletic department. I'm not going to the sociology department. I'm just taking the entire population and randomly sampling them. So why would this be important, doing it this way, versus even what Chris had said of going to the freshman seminar? Why would this way be more pure?
It's going to be like everybody, not just the freshman class, it'll be freshmen through seniors.
And it takes out, I'll say, human biases. Like, it's kind of interesting. Even if we walk into a room and I ask you to randomly select 10 people, there'll probably be some bias in your selection, almost like a subconscious bias. you might be overcompensating, saying, oh, well, women tend to be underrepresented in these type of studies, so I'm subconsciously going to be making sure to pick more women. Or, wow, the tall people just seem to stand out, and so they get noticed more, and so we pick them. This sort of eliminates all types of human biases or human tendencies to be biased in selecting a sample. And statistically, why this is important is that random samples provide averages that are centered around the correct number. So I guess if we look at the proportion of students who take summer session, if we did a non-random sample, like if we took this classroom, what proportion of students take summer session classes? If the sample was just this class, what proportion take summer session?
6 out of 6.
So 100% take summer session. And do you think that's the correct proportion of students that take summer session? The average is not centered around the correct number. It's actually skewed way over to 1, whereas let's say the correct proportion is around 20%. And if we did athletes, what proportion, just roughly, what proportion of athletes do you think take summer session?
In the football, it counts for 90%.
Okay, so 90% in football. Let's just make, we'll say like 80% of athletes take summer sessions. The correct number of Duke students is 20%. In this classroom, if we just use the classroom as a sample, it would be at 1. If we did just athletes, it isn't centered around the correct number. What if we did it through this random sampling where we just randomly picked 60 Duke students? It's going to be centered right around 20%. The proportion who say, yes, I'm taking summer session classes is going to be right around 20%. And so this is important that we're ultimately interested in the correct number, but we're getting that number by looking at a sample. And if we have a random sample, it's going to be centered around that correct number. It's not going to be exact because we're only looking at 60 students versus 6,000, but it's going to be close. So then the random samples allows you to make the best estimate about the population. It's not going to be exact, but it's going to be much better than a non-random sample, like if we take this class or we take the athletic department. And so non-random samples suffer from sampling bias, and the averages are likely not to be centered around the correct number. So when I say averages, it's whatever variable we're interested in. If it's a quantitative variable, we look at the average value for that variable. So with taking summer session, it's either yes or no, and so we want to know the proportion that are taking summer session. And that's the thing that we're interested in knowing. We can best estimate that if it's a random sample. Okay. So jelly beans, maybe easier, more intuitive. Think of a bowl of jelly beans. In fact, think of it like a huge vat of jelly beans, just tons and tons of jelly beans. And we want to take a sample. The sample is just sort of reaching in and grabbing. And one way to do it is to grab non-randomly into the bowl and to pull out a sample. And if you're like my son, you grab all the black jelly beans. You have a handful of black jelly beans. That sample, which is a legitimate sample, he pulled out 10 jelly beans, that's a biased sample. It's not reflective of the entire population. So what would be a better way to take a random sample of the bowl of jelly beans? What could I do to my son to make sure he gets a good random sample? Okay, close his eyes. Put blindfold on him. Look at that. Perfect. Look at that. Close his eyes. And if you reach in with your eyes closed and pull out, you're going to get a random sample. It's not going to be biased like having all black jelly beans. But the thing that's interesting, even when you do things like that, there's still potential for error in that what if for some reason the red jelly beans are heavier? They're going to sink to the bottom and they're going to be less likely to be chosen. Or what if some of the jelly beans are sticky and they stick together, and so they're going to clump together and they're going to come out more easily than the other ones. And you can think of human analogies to that, where certain people groups cluster together, and so if you go into a population and try and randomly sample, you might not actually get a random sample. So that's where literally the random number generator is probably the most commonly used thing, because it's a purely random selection. And so whatever your population is, you assign them a number. You go to that little computer program or other ones and just say, okay, give me 60 random numbers and that's how I'm going to pick it. Versus trying to think of some scheme of how to do it and try and be as unbiased as possible, because you'll end up being biased in some way. So, and the reason why this is important is when you look at statistical claims, one of the big questions you need to ask people is, well, who was sampled? And how was that sample generated? Because that will give you a lot of insight into, is this a robust claim? Does it have problems because of who was asked? Basically, each unit of the population has the same chance of being selected. So moving on, sampling challenges. So while a random sample is ideal, it's not always feasible. So a list of the entire population might not be available. An example would be, one of the things I study is churches in the U.S. And there is no list of all the churches in the U.S. You could probably help me with this. How could I get a list of all the churches in the U.S.?
Most churches have like hierarchies, so if you like European Catholic churches, if you go to the bishop's office,
uh-huh.
You do provide a list of all the Catholic churches.
Okay.
But then you'd have to go through every denomination, and then some of them don't have hierarchies or their own church.
Yeah, and that's a pathway that we went down was, okay, well, let's just go to all the sort of national governing bodies of these denominations and ask them for a list. And actually, we got quite a few, but then someone said, well, wait, there's some non-denominational churches or unaffiliated churches. And in order to take a true random sample, you need to make sure that you have the whole population. What's another way that we could cross-check and make sure we have the entire population?
Google?
Yeah, so we could do a search. And that's actually the next thing that we did was we just Googled and got all these churches, but some were not in that. What?
Said they were not online.
Yeah, so there's some churches out there that are not online. So even though Google would be good, in order to take a truly random sample of the entire population, you need to know everyone that's in the population. So with Duke students, it's easy because you kind of know. But as you sort of go out to bigger studies, it's not always easy to have the entire population or a list of the entire population. And even some great ideas of what both of you had are really good, but they only get 90%. And so when we would do our study, it would leave out the characteristics of churches that are non-denominational or that are lower income and don't have a web presence. Our study wouldn't really be, in fact, our study would say 100% of congregations have a website. And go, wait, why? That doesn't seem right. And then you'd ask, who did I sample? I said, well, we sampled every church that had a website. So that's where you see problems with studies if you're not sampling from the entire population or taking a random sample. Another one, it may be too difficult to contact all the members of the population. Say we're wanting to do a polling of all people in the U.S. What are some members of the U.S. population that might be difficult to contact? Okay, yeah. If you want to make sure that Amish were represented in the study, or at least had the potential to be in it, you'd have to maybe go to their house. That's a good one. Any others that you guys can think of? My 4-year-old son, he's not difficult to contact, but it might not be the best person to include in the study because if we're interested in income and things of that nature, I might say, well, okay, yes, we're interested in the entire U.S. population, but let's say everyone that's at least 18 years old. Because the people under 18, for legal reasons and other reasons, it might just be difficult to pull them away for an hour and say, can you do this survey? Other populations would be people in prison. You don't have access to them, as much access to involve them in studies. And so you'll notice a lot of times with surveys, they'll say, this is a study of the U.S. population of all people who are non-institutionalized or not in like a prison or some other institution that prohibits them from being accessed. And so that's the reason why they'll include that. So as I was saying, sometimes your population might need to be altered. If we were, again, let's say Duke students in summer session, we might say all Duke students who are not studying abroad, because like we don't want to spend the money or time to get in touch with the study abroad students. So you need to define your population in a reasonable way and then sample from that population. So you might initially want to know about every Duke student, but you're like, it's too hard to maybe get that population listed. So let's just say the ones that are studying in the U.S. at Duke. And then you can only make inferences about the population that you circumscribe. So then there's this idea of quasi-random sampling. You have this large population, you want to take a subset of the population, And so we're doing a study where we want to estimate the average number of hours that Duke students spend studying each week. So what are the potential problems associated with the proposed sampling techniques? We don't have, let's say, the money to do this random number generator thing because we're just going to go out and do it. And so we say, okay, we want to know the average number of hours that Duke students spend studying each week. Let's go to Perkins Library and ask all the students there how much they study. What are the potential problems associated with this sampling process? Yes?
The library is typically working to study, so most people that are in the library
study. Okay. Let's say that the correct number, the true number of average hours that Duke students study is 10 hours a week. But if we went into the library and sampled 60 people, what do you think would be the average number of hours represented by that sample? If 10 hours is the population average, just a rough estimate. Okay. So in a sense, if we sampled students in the Duke Library, let's say the average would be 20 hours. And so the average of the sample wouldn't be centered around the mean. This is an important point, that if your estimate is way over here and skewed, you can't make a good inference about what the true number is. And basically the concept behind this is sampling units based on something related to the variables you're analyzing. So if you want to know about hours studying and you go into the library and ask those people, just as Chelsea said, it's going to be skewed towards the thing that you're trying to measure. Okay, here's maybe a trickier one. You email all Duke students and ask them how much they study, and use all the data you get. So somehow you get access to the universal email, and you just spam everybody and say, quick question, how many hours do you study each week? What's a potential problem with this sampling technique? It goes to every student. Yeah.
Could be because people who study more are always on the computer more often. Could be that.
Okay.
Maybe checking the emails more often than someone who doesn't.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, at first I was like, oh yeah, perfect, beautiful, I've solved my problem. I'm just going to send it out, and it's going to be random who replies back. But then Chris comes up to me and says, yeah, but what about the people who just sit on their computer all the time? It could go the other direction. It could be people are procrastinating and not studying, and they say, oh, I'll respond to this email, or, you know. So there's problems when you let your sample be comprised of whoever chooses to participate. It's called like a volunteer bias. And again, these might be more obvious examples, but as we analyze or critique the research that we look at, it's an important question to ask of, well, where'd you get your sample from? And a lot of times, people will do convenient samples, what's easiest, and so the results, you can't trust them as much because the sample that they're using to make inference about the population is not representative. Even though they have statistical evidence and they show you all these figures, if their sample isn't reflective of the population, it's not something you can trust. We have population, we have sample, there's sampling bias, and then from our sample, we gather data, but there's also other forms of bias. And so ultimately, what we're trying to do is to get data about the sample that basically reflects the whole population, but there's a lot of steps involved to make sure that our data doesn't have biases in it. And biases is just like what Chelsea said, if you ask people in the library how much you study, average value is going to be skewed in this direction. You can't say anything with confidence about the average number of hours Duke students study. So other forms of bias. So even with random sample, data can still be biased. So non-response is one form of bias. And it's sort of like what Chris was alluding to. If the people who respond to the survey tend to answer differently than the people who do not respond, the responses will be biased. So I might say, I want to know how many Duke students are in a significant relationship. And so I pull my sample. I actually get a random sample. And I have 100 students that I've sampled, and I ask, one of the questions is, are you in a significant relationship? Let's say the people who are not dating or have just broken up are like, I don't want to answer that question. And so they leave it blank. But all the people who are dating are excited about the relationship, and they're like, oh, yes, I'm in a relationship. And so then you're going to have the non-responses is we don't have any information on, but we have information on the 50, in a sense, who are dating, and all of them say yes. It's going to look like 100% or a larger proportion of students are dating than really are, because there was something about the people who responded that was different from the people who didn't respond. one of the things that studies report is what was the response rate. And if the response rate is low, if only 50% of the people responded, you're like, we have no idea about the other 50%. We can't really make strong claims based on this data because we took a random sample, but only 50% of those people responded. So we don't really know about this other 50%. One of the examples would be, what is your income level? So that's a common question on surveys is, what's your income level? And that's probably one of the questions that has the highest number of non-responses. And so what would be characteristics of people who don't respond that would relate to their income level? What type of person would maybe not respond to that question?
Peasant.
Okay. So someone who doesn't have much income or any income?
Good.
Even people who are uber wealthy are kind of like, I don't really want to disclose that. So what you actually find is on both ends of the spectrum, perhaps the super wealthy and the super poor put no response. And so the data that we have will center around the average income, but what we will miss is the values way out here. So if we want to know what the maximum income level in our sample is, we're not going to know it because there's a good chance that that person didn't respond. Oh, here's an interesting one. If you go to a restaurant, sometimes these days, they'll send you an email afterwards saying, hey, please rate your experience at the restaurant. And they send it out to all the people who came just to get a sense of how well they're doing. What problems would you see with this?
Well, I mean, usually the people that are going to respond to someone who had a really good thing or a really bad thing.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Exactly. The managers are going to be kind of confused because they're going to be like, oh my gosh, like we're schizophrenic as a restaurant. Like some people just love us and are off the charts. There's no one in the middle. And then there's a bunch of people who hate us. And like that just doesn't seem consistent with our experience of the clientele in our restaurant. A lot of times the type of person who responds is going to have a different experience or different characteristics than the person who doesn't respond. So all of the people who had an average experience are not responding, and so they're not included in the study. An important thing is look at the non-response rate. Another one would be purely by the way the question is worded would put bias into the data. So a question in one of the Gallup polls would be, do you support gay marriage? And that will generate a certain type of response. Whereas if you ask the question, do you think the government should restrict same-sex partners from getting married? So both of them are asking about the same issue, same-sex marriage. What do you think would be the differences in outcomes, depending on which question we chose to use?
Like some people don't support it, but they don't see a problem with the government.
Okay. Someone could take either of these questions and do a study. If they did this one, they're probably going to end up saying fewer people are in favor of Amendment 1. Amendment 1 is the, I don't know if it's in favor or opposed, but basically is for same-sex marriage. And whereas if you ask this question, which is, it seems fairly close. What?
A lot of people are more against, like, government restricting things. Like,
uh-huh.
More likely to be against that than supporting gay marriage, especially gay. Like, I feel like a lot of people wouldn't say they support gay marriage, but at the same time, they don't want to, like, say the government to restrict something.
Yeah. So if you voted against Amendment 1, you could answer the same way to these questions. And if someone does a report and says, well, we surveyed people in Durham about same-sex marriage, and 20% said were in favor of it. But then another study asked this question, and they came out with the result that 50% were in favor of it. And so the idea is looking at the question that was asked versus like, okay, well, they said the proportion of people in favor of same-sex marriage is this. You say, well, what did you ask them? They can do the right statistics and do the random sampling and do all the right things, but it's also good to look at the actual questions that were asked. Another one would be the context in which the survey happens. So here's one that comes up a lot that people didn't really pick up on until they started analyzing it. So here's the scenario. A black interviewer asking a white respondent survey questions related to racism. In what ways could this context skew or bias the response?
He's going to be worried with how the guy, like the interviewer reacts if he says it online.
Yeah. So you wouldn't necessarily be completely forthright. And really, they've done these studies where if they switch this and put a white interviewer asking a white respondent, they get very different results. And so you might not even think to ask, well, who interviewed the person? Again, there's subtle things that almost unbeknownst to us seep into it, because people have been doing these studies all the time and they hire interviewers and they send them out to do the surveys and not even really thinking about how the actual interviewer, the person asking the questions, could affect the data that they're collecting. Another one would be asking questions about sensitive information that the respondent might not want to publicly disclose. With the general social survey, they have questions about sexual activity and stuff. And so they have an interviewer who's asking them the questions, but when they get to these sensitive questions, what they do is have the respondent enter it onto a computer anonymously. Rather than having the interviewer ask how many sexual partners you've had in the last year, they just say, okay, this is the part of the survey where I give you the computer and you just answer. You just enter it in. And so they don't have to worry about the person withholding information because they're awkward about the interviewer being there. But again, that's not even completely foolproof, because the person would be like, well, I'm not going to put this information in a computer. What are they going to do with it? So another one that comes up, and again, these are all forms of bias in the data. So we've already collected a random sample of people, but now we're gathering data from them, and we want to make sure we're getting accurate responses. So this is an interesting one. If you ask the question, in the last year, how many times have you attended a religious service? You know, if you ask me, I mean, we go to church, but in the last year, how do I count that up? That's just a really difficult thing to sort of land on an accurate number. Another way to ask the question is, in the last year, how often did you attend a religious service? And I'd be, oh, let's see, once a week, once a month, one to two times, never. About once a month. It's a better way to ask the question to get more accurate responses. It's not as precise, but it's going to be less difficult on the brain to figure that out. You can just sort of look at it and be like, oh yeah, we go about once a month. So here's another one. How old were you when your first child was born?
I don't know. Like,
what'd you say?
When
you want to
ask what year was your child born?
No, hey, look at that. Man, Timothy's on it. Exactly. So, in what year was your first child born? Now, believe it or not, this one's even hard.
I don't know. You can't remember your child.
Well, no.
I feel like once they get older, though, like once kids hit, like, their 20s, 30s, you can keep track of years. Like, if your kid's, like, 4 or 5, you're going to know.
But. Yeah. So, well, and another way is, how old is your first child? So this is interesting, because you're like, well, how does that let you know how old you were when your first child was born? Well, you're going to have when this person was born, and you're going to have the year in which the survey was done. And if you ask how old is your child, you say, oh, he's 24 years old. Then we can do the math and figure it out. And this is just a simple example, but there's some really elaborate things that they do that make it easy on the respondent to give a quick, accurate answer. And then we go and do the work to get the information that we want. But the whole idea is, if we're asking someone questions that are complicated or make them do mental gymnastics, there's a higher likelihood of them making an error in their response and us getting inaccurate information. So all this kind of goes back to, there might be a variable that you're interested in, and you're like, oh great, I have a variable on crime. But it's important to look at what's the question behind that variable, what's the context in which it was asked, and what are the potential problems with this question. The last one would be social desirability. So if I ask this class, you're in my survey, and I say, in the last year, have you cheated on any academic assignment or exams? Please answer. I'm probably not going to get the correct response. I'm going to get the response that you think I want to hear. And this is a common thing. I mean, another one would be, how many hours a week do you study? You know, if your friends ask you, you'll give one type of response. But if your instructor asks you, you're going to give another type of response. Same person, same world, but because of the desire to sort of have a socially desirable response is going to skew the answer. So again, look at the question, look at who is asking the question, what's the context for that. There's tons of bias. It's almost impossible to eliminate bias, but the important thing is to be able to identify it and then to account for it. And one way of accounting for it is simply being forthright about it. you know, in the ideal world, we would have done this, but because of limitations, we had to ask the question this way. And so it could be biased in this direction, so just be aware of that. And I think if you do that, then people will give you grace and not be as critical. But if you try and cover it up or try and be sneaky about it, and then people fish it out, they'll be like, well, why are you trying to hide it? So it's okay. There is going to be bias in some form, and you'll demonstrate that you're a sharp student or researcher if you say, hey, I'm aware of this bias. So sort of almost you anticipate their criticisms, and you say, yeah, in an ideal world, we wouldn't have any bias, but there is this bias, and here's what it is. Our answers might be skewed slightly in one direction or another. Let's see. Okay. Hey, we're getting towards the end. This is the assignment, and I'll post this stuff online as well, but I'm going to spend the last like 5 minutes or whatever going through this part two. This is sort of like the parts of the assignment that are going to involve building towards your final research project. And as I mentioned, we're going to be using the general social survey. And so this is going to be sort of your first attempt at beginning to explore this data and going through and pulling out variables that you're going to use for your research. What I want you to begin thinking about is you can pick any topic you want to study, any type of questions, sociological questions that you're interested in, and then we're going to use the general social survey as the place where you're going to get the data from. And so I'm going to walk you guys through that so you can see. So I just clicked on the link in the PowerPoint, and so you guys can pull that up. This is the interface for gathering the data. And also, are all you guys meeting with the tutors? Okay, good. So they know this, and so they can help you navigate it. But basically, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on it. So along here is all the different variables that were asked. So the first one would be right here is respondent background variables. So the respondent is the case, the person that's being interviewed. So let's say we want to know about what are all the variables related to age, gender, race, and ethnicity. And so if we go here, we click on that and it says age of respondent, and then you go up here. So I put it right in there. You go up here and you click view. So it gives you a description of the variable, which is basically respondent's age. And then you can look at this and say, okay, the values range from age 18 to, what do you think it goes up to? What's the oldest person in this study, do you think?
113.
113, let's see. Oh, well, so they cut it off, 89 or older. So they say if you're over 89, you're probably similar enough to other people who are over 89. So, but basically, this gives you a sense of, okay, the variable age. There's no one under 18 in this sample or in this study. So let's say, what are the variables related to education? This one is called father's highest degree. The variable name is PADEG, which is... it's probably paternal degree, or it's like, you know, every variable name has sort of like a compressed thing. But that's important to know the variable name, because I'll ask you, what variables are you using? So you can't just say the education one. You have to say PADEG, which is father's highest degree. And so we say, well, what does that variable tell us? Okay, this question was, if you finished 9th through 12th grade, did he ever get a high school degree or a GED certificate? So that's interesting. It lists out, does the person have less than a high school degree? Do they have a high school degree, junior college, bachelor degree, or graduate degree? And so that would let you know father's education of the person who's in the study. Other ones that they have in here are personal and family information. So you have questions about marital status, family composition, so like if you're interested in the number of brothers or sisters, number of children they have. Hey, look at that. Age when first child was born. Let's see how they ask the question. How old were you when your first child was born? So they ask a question that makes it a little bit difficult. What do you notice about this? So the question is, how old were you when your first child was born? What do you notice about this data?
A lot of them are younger ages.
Uh-huh.
Almost like they said how old their first child was.
Ah, yeah. It's kind of like, someone answered 9. So now it's only one out of how many people are total in this? 55,000 people. So you might have to say, this just seems strange. Wait, one thing you can do is say, I want to go look at this person's entire responses and see if they have a lot of messed up weird answers. and you might decide, you know, for a number of reasons, we need to drop this person from our study because they're going to throw off all of our data. So it's important to kind of look at, does the stuff make sense? What age range? Okay, so a bulk of the people have their first child between the ages of 18 and 25. Now there's, it spreads out. Let's see if we go down here, age of first child. Look at this. One person was 65. You know, I mean, you sort of assume it's valid unless you go in and investigate and see it looks like some reason to think this is an invalid or inaccurate response. What you guys are going to be doing is basically going through these variables. There's also demographic variables, like what part of the country do they live in, occupation. Oh, here's some interesting stuff. Personal concerns. So here's like race issues. So this one is, do you think there should be laws against marriages between African-Americans and whites? And so if you wanted to do a study on racial attitudes in the U.S., this would probably be a good one to use. So there's tons of questions about the demographic makeup, like your family, your race, your age, and things like that. And then there's things about occupation, education, and then things about your attitudes and beliefs. And so for this assignment, what I basically want you to do is find 10 variables, provide the variable name, that's that sort of compressed name, and then the question associated with the variable. And I want you to pick from different sections, so don't just go into the one that says education, say your education, father's education, mother's education, and how many years of schooling do you have, you know, like pick from 10 different areas so that you can get a sense of what data is available. And then at the beginning of class, tomorrow, I'm going to ask you, hey, tell me your most interesting variable. Any questions about part two? Very good. We're all done.